Movie theaters are modern-day pulpits. Real-world theology exists to shed a light on the narratives that are shaping our culture and to remind viewers that entertainment is not mindless.
Merry Christmas! Welcome to Real World Theology, episode 84. On this episode of the podcast, we are going to talk about Die Hard, our favorite Christmas film. Whose favorite Christmas film? That's Laura Fissel, J.R. Forresteros, and myself. Is it the best Christmas movie? We think so. Maybe you don't. Well, we talk about what exactly makes a Christmas movie a Christmas movie, and how Die Hard probably fits the bill more than you'd think. So, from all of us at Real World Theology, we hope you are having the merriest of Christmases. Enjoy our love of this classic action film. It's a really, really fun, a really merry, and a really great episode. Here it is, episode 84, Die Hard and Christmas Movie Ingredients.
I feel like I missed the boat on something, because I have been probably, I mean, I know Laura's been, obviously, we kind of have this conflict against the outside world as a team, but I'm guessing based on your recent post, JR, we've all been fighting this battle of trying to fight for the legitimacy of Die Hard as a Christmas movie.
Yeah.
And I don't necessarily want to defend it right yet, but what I have noticed is ever since we decided that we were going to do Die Hard on this podcast for our Christmas episode, I have seen more pro Die Hard and more people reviewing the Die Hard movie as a Christmas movie or defending it as a Christmas movie than I have ever seen before. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, have people been checking out my notes? Like, this is actually kind of...
It's all about you, Mikey.
It's kind of... I could understand that because I'm a clever guy. I feel like this was like one of... You know, it was a little tough to push back against, but it was kind of fun to have like a wacky tradition that no one else did.
Yeah, now it's becoming kind of like the thing.
I'm gonna have to watch Predator or something.
Well, Gremlins is the next like cool movie that everyone likes, but no one really ever thought of as a Christmas movie that I think is getting a lot of buzz. Mm. That's like the next Die Hard.
Well, I'm wondering because it is Gremlins 2. Is Gremlins 2 a Christmas movie?
See, I've only seen that one, I think, when it came out.
Yeah, and it's been so long.
I don't remember if it's set at Christmas time or not.
But, you know, obviously the first one is. So what it made me think about, and this is something we talk about every year on our Christmas episode, I'm always curious what people actually do for Christmas.
On the day of Christmas.
Well, just traditions that kind of like float around the holiday.
Yeah.
So not necessarily
like things you have to always do,
or at least you try your best to do. And you know, last year we got to talk about how we watch Die Hard on Christmas Eve, or we try to watch Die Hard on Christmas Eve after our Christmas Eve service. This year it will be probably it won't happen because we won't be able to go to our Christmas Eve service. We'll be out of town with family, and that section of the family probably are not going to be thrilled to stay up until 1 a.m. and watching
Die Hard.
They're
the kind of people that you have to defend Die Hard to as a Christmas movie.
They're those people.
Shame.
So our traditions are going to look a little bit different this year, though we are continuing a tradition of once every 4 years going to meet with this one side of the family that we almost never get to see. You know, a couple different states that are represented there. And that's always fun in its own right. No Die Hard, again, downside. But, you know, it's a tradition that you get to look forward to because it's not every year. Mm-hmm. So it's every couple years. And it kind of shakes things up a little bit. So if anyone wants to know what Laura and I typically do, they can always listen to last year's episode. But what I would like to know is, like I said, again, not necessarily like on Christmas Day, though you can include that, just things around the holidays, December, the actual season of Christmas, you know, the 12 days after. What do the Forresteros like to do?
Yeah, so I'm very much an Advent Nazi, and my wife lovingly follows suit. So we don't have any decorations, no Christmas music, nothing until Christmas Eve. Mm-hmm. We will watch some Christmas movies, especially because now we live in the great country of Texas, where there is an Alamo Drafthouse, and they show Christmas movies starting in November. And so we went to the Love Actually quote along, which is Amanda's favorite Christmas movie, and the Die Hard. It wasn't a quote along, but they did give us cap guns that we could shoot at the screen anytime bad guys were on screen. So nice. That was pretty fun.
That does seem kind of dangerous. You know, like you're, I mean, I know you're giving people toy guns, but like I feel like the marketing for that is like, come to this theater. Well, we're going to give lots of people toy guns, maybe.
They don't tell you ahead of time what you get.
Okay.
It's just when you order your ticket, there's a merchandise fee, and that's how you know there's like something fun happening.
Mm.
That's cool.
Because I would say if someone marketed that right. would be like the first story and only story on like Fox News for like a week or something.
Right. No, it's so. Yeah, and like it was funny because the first time Ellis came on the screen, which he's obviously not one of the terrorists, right? But someone like clicked, like shot his gun, and the whole theater busted up laughing. So things like that like made it just a really fun time. Mm-hmm. And so we will see some of those. But then starting on Christmas Day, and this is also a carryover. So our church in Ohio was pretty large, mm-hmm. and we would do a Christmas Eve worship gathering at 5 o'clock, 7 o'clock, 8 o'clock, and 11 o'clock p.m. Do like a midnight mass kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So we were at the church building from 4:30 to like 12:30 on mm-hmm. Christmas Eve. So Christmas Day we did nothing. We would go see movies in the movie theater. We had this like special recipe that it was from my family growing up that we called corn dip, mm-hmm. and it's like, it's pepper jack cheese, cream cheese, and corn. It's like all mixed together and melted together, and then you eat it with nacho cheese Doritos.
And it sounds amazing.
It is amazing. It's like super unhealthy. It was always our Christmas treat. So we would like go see a movie in the theater or two, and then come home and watch Christmas movies and eat corn dip. And that was like that was all we did on Christmas Day. It was like a nice low key recovery day.
Well, yeah, but it's the end of Advent. It's a celebration.
It's a celebration feast day, right? Yeah. And so then we actually do the 12 days of Christmas. So we'll exchange gifts for 12 days, and just keep the party going. That's when we start listening to Christmas music. So on January 4th, I'm still rocking O Holy Night and all that, and everyone else hasn't listened to it since December 26th. And I'm like, you Grinches! It's only like the 11th day of Christmas. What's wrong with you?
You've given up on Christmas.
Yeah. So that's always a little bit weird by the time I pull up somewhere and it's January 5th and I'm blasting out, you know, Christina Aguilera's Christmas songs, and everyone's like, what's wrong with that guy? But that's the kind of stuff we do. You know, we put up our tree and do all our ornaments. I have a lot of Star Trek ornaments from when I was a kid.
Mm-hmm.
We lovingly plug in the Klingon Bird of Prey, so its blasters are set to, you know, fire and all that.
But you don't do that till Christmas Day?
Christmas Eve or Christmas Day, Christmas yeah. Eve? I've gotten pretty soft in my old age, and Christmas Eve now, a lot of times decorations will go up. So.
Oh, man. Give an
Why
inch.
Why do it at all?
Yeah.
Really, really backsliding.
Yeah, so. You're really, really... gosh, that's just terrible, JR. Okay, well...
We're like the only Christmas tree on the block that's like on the curb January 10th or 11th.
Yeah, everyone's had theirs gone for quite a while. And just, what can you do?
It's really fun on the second Sunday after Christmas. It's usually like the 10th or 11th day of Christmas. Mm-hmm. It's into the new year. And when you get up and wish everyone Merry Christmas, and the whole congregation is like, what is wrong with you, man? So weird.
So it helps a lot now that we go to an Anglican church because more people are accustomed to it. But, you know, there's fighting society for things.
Right.
So people understand why we say it, why we do it. And, you know, when our pastor gets up and says Merry Christmas, you know, the second Sunday after Christmas, people are like, I got it. We're Anglican, you know, but, you know, their Christmas trees are probably already on the curb, et cetera. So do you do any, because people might not know the difference, and we're all being, this is our new Die Hard. Advent is our new Die Hard since Die Hard's being accepted now. So maybe if we talk about Advent, then people will start doing Advent.
Yeah.
So do you do anything special for Advent?
We don't. I mean, as a family, we don't. In the church, we do the wreath, and we don't sing Christmas songs. Mm-hmm. we do things like that. Our whole series is very much, we talk about, this is Advent, it's a time of preparation, it's a time of waiting. Mm-hmm. We do those kinds of things. But yeah, as a family, we don't do an Advent calendar or anything like that. Again, that would maybe be different if we had kids or something. Mm-hmm. And we were talking about how it seems like Advent calendars are all of a sudden really in again. Mm-hmm. Like there's beer of the day Advent calendars, mm-hmm. and different things like that that I'm just super not interested in. I like the idea, I guess, of an Advent calendar, but...
Well, I mean, it's anything that you can sell people, so they don't care what the reason is, right? Right.
I mean, when I was a kid, our Advent calendars were like gross little chocolates.
Yeah.
Right?
Is that like the one you have, Lauren?
Yes.
It was always like, yay, you get to open it. Oh, now someone has to eat it.
Yeah, I'm kind of like, yay, I get to open the door. Oh, there's another chocolate.
Yeah.
I mean, if you think about it, they have to have been sitting around for a long time.
Right. Well, that's also, I will say the other thing that makes it hard to get into the, like, holiday spirit is that I live in Texas now. So today it was, like, 55 and sunny. And I was just like,
I think it was warmer here.
Yeah.
Yeah, it just doesn't... I mean, mm-hmm. I grew up in the Midwest, so mm-hmm. starting in, you know, by Thanksgiving, you were guaranteed that it was Arctic cold, mm-hmm. and then by Christmas time, it was always just, like, super cold, like in the 20s and 30s, and it's just not... It doesn't even get that cold here at night, so it just... My like, psyche has not adjusted to feeling like we're building up to Christmas, so if I didn't have the rhythms of the church, it would completely sneak up on me.
Mm-hmm. So... So where does Die Hard fit in with your Christmas tradition? Is that Christmas Day?
We don't have like a strict schedule, and part of that's because everything's been so up in the air. Like again, for us, it kind of depends on when Christmas falls. Like if Christmas ends up being on a Saturday or a Sunday or something, or you know midweek, and so we really more have things that we do during the Christmas season. Not necessarily on the specific day of Christmas,
just
if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so it always, you know, always fluctuates a little bit. Last year, Amanda actually had to work on Christmas Day, and so I sat by myself at the house on Christmas Day and didn't do anything, and then I just made a big dinner so that when she finally got off work, we could, like, watch a movie and do that. And then I think we did 12 days of movies for Christmas, and so mm-hmm. we watched several different films, and mm-hmm. they weren't all Christmas movies or whatever, but Love Actually and Die Hard are the two... like must watches. It's her favorite and my favorite. So I declare Die Hard my favorite Christmas movie. It's one I watch at least on Christmas, during Christmas time every year, if not more times a year than that. So
Laura, mm-hmm. I don't think I've actually asked you this question directly. I think I just put it under the category of I appreciate highly how cool my wife is and I don't deserve her. Like there's a category. Suck up a little bit, but why are you cool with the fact that our tradition is watching Die Hard? Like, why Die Hard?
I've never really thought about it before, but I thought about it for tonight.
Yes!
And, I think one of the reasons I love it so much is that it's not like all the movies I watched growing up on Christmas. And I love those too. Like White Christmas is one of our family traditions. I love that movie. Wonderful Life, mm-hmm. Christmas Carol. But it takes a lot of very familiar Christmas themes, music, decorations, and it just juxtaposes it against this new backdrop. I don't know. I love the contrast of the film. Mm-hmm. I think it's hilarious. It just makes me think about Christmas in a different way than like very unabashedly sentimental mm-hmm. Christmas movies. So maybe that's why.
Well, I mean, that works for me because, like I said, it gets us watching what I would consider not just my favorite Christmas movie, not just one of the best Christmas movies, unarguably, but one of the best movies that has ever been made. A movie that has redefined a genre, if you will. And we get to watch that. And being able to watch that once a year is always something that I've enjoyed. Mm-hmm. I really love this the cheesiness of it. I love the fact that it's, you know, your everyman hero doing something funny. Bruce Willis is, I mean, he cracks me up. Like, it's it's that great, great balance of like action, kind of like serious stakes, but kind of like not too serious that it can't almost make fun of itself.
Right.
Because it has so many little tropes and stuff in it.
I mean, if it didn't have a good sense of humor about itself, then the script, you just... you know, I mean, the only reason you can take it seriously is because they're not taking it seriously.
Yeah.
The script is awesome.
Yeah, it invites you to roll your eyes and say, come on. And it's like, I know, right? So much fun.
Exactly. Right. And I think that in and of itself is a very hard balance to strike. And I think even more so considering, you know, when I was going back and looking at kind of like who was involved in making this movie around what else was coming out when Die Hard was made.
Mm-hmm.
And I realized that the director, John McTiernan, he's also the dude that directed Predator.
Mm-hmm.
So in 1987, he directs one of the most macho, like, you know, bro, big machine gun, hunting a big alien with face paint on and camo
Arnold.
Gear.
Arnold.
Yeah. almost the epitome of the action genre.
Mm-hmm.
And then the very next year, he makes Die Hard, which is almost the antithesis of Predator.
Mm-hmm.
Which is just crazy to me to see kind of the stake in history. It just nails down and says, our movies don't have to look like Commando or Rambo anymore.
Right.
Like, they can be something else. They can be silly, but not silly because they don't know they're silly.
Here's a hero you can identify with as you decide, like, want to emulate them.
Mm-hmm. And not only that, but, like, the bad guy's cool. You know, it's Alan Rickman's first time in a film. Like, he only did TV before he did Die Hard. And, you know, thank goodness for Die Hard. Because we have gotten to enjoy Alan Rickman.
Mm-hmm.
This is one of those 6 degrees of separation or 9 degrees of separation or whatever. Because Alan Rickman apparently is striking gold in Christmas movies. Right, JR?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's Amanda joyfully observed this year that he's in both of our favorite Christmas films, right?
Yeah, kind of a jerk in both.
Spoilers for Love Actually.
Yeah. but
he does it so well.
I
mean, Snape, come on. I mean, he's kind of got a thing going on.
Okay, can we just talk about who actually loved Snape? Because I always loved Snape.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. He's always...
Actually, well, I'll say this. And maybe this is where your question's going, but when I watch the Harry Potter franchise, having not read the books, only going on what I saw in the films, and this has got me, I guess, in trouble sometimes with the Harry Potter crowd. So I preface the knowledge of what I'm saying.
Prepare yourself for the emails now.
That's right. You can leave all your hate in the comments. Like, I never liked Harry Potter. Like the character. I never liked Harry. I felt like he was really unlikable. And I thought, at worse than Harry in the movies, was his dad. I was like, Harry's dad is a terrible human being. And
that's true in the books as well. As the books go on, you're less and less enamored with James Potter.
Yeah. And so
you're like, wow, he was kind of like an alpha male jock. Like, that was kind of his
exactly.
Shtick.
So by proxy, we have Harry's mom having terrible taste in men, basically, you know, marrying the high school quarterback who's going to live his glory days all his life. And meanwhile, Snape is the real hero of the Harry Potter. Like, he's the only one who's, like, really sacrificing. He's got unrequited love. He's incredibly interesting. He's working on many levels. He's a double, triple, quadruple agent. I was like, I don't understand why he gets crapped on in Harry Potter.
I feel like this goes back to 16 candles for you.
It probably does. It probably does go back to 16.
Well, and the other thing, I mean, even like in the first two books before, you know, any of the backstory about Harry's parents and Snape, like, if you've just ever been a teacher who actually cared whether or not your students learned something, you sort of hate Harry and Ron, and you sort of are like, yeah, Snape, like, too bad he's a good teacher who wants his students to learn. Like, poor fellow, you know? Like,
We're not at Hogwarts to learn, JR. We're here to fight he who will not be named.
Yeah, right.
Don't the Harry Potter movies sometimes happen around Christmas? Or do stuff over
Christmas? Well, Christmas, they're the whole year at school. So
yeah, yeah.
So there is
eventually they always have some kind of Christmas segment obviously. That occurs.
Yeah. Anyone who was about to take me seriously with my Harry Potter critique was like, she doesn't even know. So, sidetrack. Well, okay, so in Die Hard, though.
Alan Rickman.
Alan Rickman is in it, and it's awesome.
Sorry.
So, it's amazing to me that there's countless callbacks in TV shows and homages, and we were actually talking about Brooklyn Nine-Nine just this week. This goes back to what I was talking about, JR. Like, I'm going to podcast on this week. JR just happens to write this thing on it. A friend of the show, James Harleman, decided to show it in a Christmas series at his church and kind of give it a rundown, which I'll probably put in the show notes. And, you know, Brooklyn Nine-Nine decides this is the week they're going to do their Christmas episode is going to be a Die Hard episode. And I'm just like, everyone's on the Die Hard train now.
It's perfect.
Is it some kind of, it's not some kind of anniversary, is it? How old is Die Hard?
Oh, 88.
No, it's 88. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, we got.
It's a pretty cool number.
We got, wait, 30th anniversary, right? 30th.
Like two more years. Yeah.
Yeah. And then we, maybe we should have just waited. We could have got the Back to the Future treatment. You know, where were you?
We have time to build a Nakatomi Tower, guys. Hurry up.
Good. Well, there's probably already a couple of Nakatomi Towers in Qatar. That's where John McClane's going to go next. In
the prequel?
In Die Hard 6, the Diediest.
You know that they greenlit the prequel, right?
Oh, no, I didn't know they greenlit the prequel. I thought they were going to make another...
No, it's going to be a prequel, and it's going to be John McClane in the 70s and as a cop in New York.
I hope so, because that means he gets a porn stash.
Apparently, Bruce Willis will be bookending the film, but it's going to be a prequel.
So he's not playing himself.
Well, he is.
He is not playing the young
John.
Okay,
that would be great because that would be like Wet Hot American Summer.
Well, I mean, I don't know. Maybe he is. I mean, they haven't actually said either way.
Oh. Okay, well, I want to get to... Well, no, let's just go ahead and address it now. Elephant in the room. What went wrong? Like, why do we have so many Die Hard movies, and why have they progressively gotten...
I'll tell you exactly
less good.
Oh, but I like... What is it, 3 with Samuel?
Yeah, yeah.
I like that one.
Yeah, well, it progressively gotten worse.
Okay, what's your theory?
Okay, here? Well, what's your ranking? Because mine is 1, 3, 4, 2, and 5 doesn't exist. It's like, I can't break.
Okay, so that's,
it's like the Crystal Skull.
I was exactly with you. I think that's where I'd rank mine. Mm. I feel like that's probably critic consensus.
Yeah, it's nearly objective gospel truth.
Mm. Yeah. I mean, you know, because it's...
I honestly don't remember anything other than 1 and 3, so...
Okay, you know, so 1
well,
is...
Well, there's like a plain one.
1 is classic, yeah.
2 is the plain one, okay. And it's the entirety of 2 is, man, remember last year when this all happened the exact same way? That was crazy, huh?
Yeah.
Like, that's... They say that over and over in 2.
Gotcha.
3's good.
I like the Justin Jackson's. Long one, okay? Is that...
That's 4.
That's 4. 4.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's... Live Free or Die Hard.
Yep. Die Hard.
Yep.
You got me that for Christmas one year.
Yes, I did. Not only that, not only does it have Justin Long in it, you're forgetting that Tim Olyphant is the bad guy.
That's right.
So Justified shows up.
So yeah, I guess I am 1, 3, 4, 2.
Yeah, and then.
And then,
then they try to put Jack Courtney in 1 for some reason.
And the Abomination.
Why do they put Jack Courtney in anything? What's the thing that he's been in that people are like, oh yeah,
he'll be good in this
one. Oh yeah.
You know, I mean, I'm going to be honest. I think it might just be his jawline.
Yeah. Well, because didn't we talk about this a little bit on the Terminator podcast? Like,
yeah.
Like, who said Jack Courtney? That's going to do it. That's going to be the one.
You know what this movie needs?
I want someone to say, yeah, I know what it doesn't need.
Yeah. So what happened in the Die Hard franchise?
Yes.
Was they forgot that Bruce Willis... Or, excuse me, they forgot that John McClane is an everyman.
Mm-hmm.
Live Free or Die Hard is a superhero movie. He fights a jet with his hands and wins. He throws a car at a helicopter and wins.
Seems legit.
I mean, that's fine. Like, those are cool action sequences, and they work in the film, but he is a superhero. Mm-hmm. And it's to the point that when it happens in the self-referential way that the Die Hard series has, he just laughs about it. You know, he's like, ha, 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 like, wow, look what I did.
Yeah.
And that's not what made people love John McClane in the first Die Hard.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Well, and even though his everyman-ness kind of defies reality, like, he has always been a superhero on some level. Like, he's like a Batman, though. He's like a person, or he's like a Tony Stark, kind of. Except without the gadgets and stuff. Like, he's still a human. Like, he's not got a power. But, like, even in the first one, like, yeah, there's an Honest Action video I found from the guys who do Honest Trailers.
Uh-huh.
And they're like, it would have taken 4 John McClanes to live through all the things that John, you know, because it was like, this happens, throat punch, John McClane dies, you know.
But you do get the sense that, like, he's barely hanging on.
Yeah.
That there's a lot of chance that's in his favor. And he takes a lot of hits. I mean, that last scene where he is dragging his bloodied body into the room where his wife has a gun to her head, you know.
He's like, ah!
Yeah, that's why it's so believable. And then that way, he's not really like Batman, because he has skills, but he's often relying on luck. I mean, like, when he throws the C4 down the elevator, he's like, whatever, I'm just gonna try something, and almost kills himself.
Yeah, and when the fire's coming up, he's like, uh-oh! Like, yeah. Oh no! Like, that was unexpected!
Yeah.
He's like, that wasn't part of my standard New York cop training. Right. The explosion wasn't. The making of the bomb obviously was.
And it was just genius to tell a story where he doesn't have any of his weapons with him. He doesn't even have shoes on. Like, he has nothing, because then it's purely his ingenuity, you know? And yeah, there are all kinds of moments in the story, even if you allow for a little bit of, like, durability or diehardness, if you will. But even still, there are moments, you know, like when he's in the vent, and if Carl had just shot, like, one more panel, he probably would have gotten killed, right? Yeah, yeah, of course. But we're watching a movie, and we suspend a little bit of our disbelief for that. It's kind of and that's, I think, as an audience member, it's that amount of luck that makes us, even though we know we're watching a movie where the good guy's going to win, it still gives us that, like, apprehension, you know, that things could go wrong, and if he gets shot, it's going to hurt, you know?
Mm-hmm. I mean, at least a little bit.
Yeah.
He'll bleed on some stuff, and then wrap it up and keep going.
And keep going, but he's going to limp.
Okay, so let me ask you this. Since Die Hard was kind of the first to do something like this, is Home Alone really just a long homage to Die Hard?
Just? Maybe not just, but sure.
I just needed Kevin McAllister to walk through or go through a vent or something. But it's basically, you know, him going around his house, using whatever is around him to fight the terrorist trying to get into his house.
Yeah, yeah. You wanted John McClane to say, "Keep the change, you filthy animals."
That's right. So we circle back around to something that I thought we'd talk about first,
and we're gonna get to it fourth.
But we're getting to it like fourth or fifth, which is completely fine because this is the Christmas episode. And the Christmas episode is loose.
First, we had to talk about Snape.
Exactly.
We
had to talk about
any number of things.
Of duh. okay. So this is what I like about the Christmas episode. It's an extra episode, so we get to have a little more fun with it than normal. We don't have to be as serious. Obviously,
yeah. Normally, these are such a drag.
You're very serious. They're like academic.
Oh yeah.
Usually.
Can't even crack a smile.
People are always like, how do you get on Real World? And I'm like, trust me, you don't want to. Major snooze fest.
So much reading.
Yeah.
You had to write a research paper.
He's like interrogating you the whole time.
That's right. What do you think? Do you think Home Alone is really just Die Hard in the suburbs of New York?
First he was a cop. Then he was a cop in a plane. Then he was a child in a house.
And then he found Samuel L. Jackson. And then stuff got crazy. Okay, so what I thought we would talk about first, but obviously we haven't for great reasons, is that even though society as a whole is starting to embrace the Die Hard phenomena, calling it right now, as a Christmas movie. They're accepting the fact that movies like Gremlins or Die Hard or whatever are Christmas movies, whether it be because it's cool to be nerdy about things now, or people are just coming around, or whatever reason. There are a number of people who would consider it not a Christmas movie. And since we all think it's probably the best Christmas movie, how would we... What is it about Die Hard that makes it a Christmas movie? Specifically. Or I guess, you know, what is it... What makes a Christmas movie?
That's, I think, a better question.
Yeah.
Because... That is, so the easy answer is that it's set at Christmas, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's set at Christmas, so it's a Christmas movie. But I think, obviously, when most people say this is a Christmas movie, they mean that the point of the movie is, in some sense, making a statement about the beauty of the Christmas season.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So, I just watched Krampus. I don't know if you guys got to see that yet or not. But... you know, it's about the anti-Santa Claus, Krampus,
yes.
Right? It's a horror movie set at Christmas time, but the point of the movie is really about the true spirit of Christmas.
Mm-hmm.
And so it is unquestionably a Christmas movie, even though it's like an anti-Santa Claus movie.
Yeah.
And not anti in the sense that it's like saying Santa is Satan or something dumb like that.
Yep.
Like, it's like, no, he's literally like the anti-Claus. So, but yeah, it's a Christmas movie. Elf, right? It's all about embracing the true spirit and believing in Christmas and all these mm-hmm. esoteric things that don't actually make any sense when you say them out loud. But
yeah,
you feel good about Christmas at the end of the movie.
Hmm. What makes... That's so interesting because, I mean, that's what I would say. But then I'm thinking... So I'm thinking about how Christmas movies explore themes that we think about around Christmas, like about the value of family or
mm-hmm.
doing good to others or... You know, seeing
generosity,
and seeing the world as a beautiful place with a lot to give, but other movies explore that. So, what makes it different around Christmas time, especially for people who aren't religious? I guess
mm-hmm.
I don't know if that's unfair, but
well, especially if the criteria is, or if the counter argument is, oh well, just because it's set at Christmas time, doesn't make it a Christmas movie. So if that's your counter argument, then you have to come up with something pretty good. And if we're kind of taking us by our own argument that most Christmas movies, or when people think of Christmas movies, especially if their first go-to isn't that it happens at Christmas time,
mm-hmm.
that it deals with something like generosity or being kind or being good or thinking of others first or whatever, you know, general cultural thing people can kind of come together and say Christmas or the holiday is mm-hmm. about, then I think that's a great point, Laura. Like, what is it? So many other movies do that, you know? Why aren't they Christmas movies?
Mm-hmm.
So is it the combination that you have to have both? Or I think it was you, JR, that pointed out in your review, I believe it was you, or it was either you or James, obviously, that said It's a Wonderful Life actually has very little to do with Christmas.
That must have been James, but I have not said that publicly because I don't want to get drawn and quartered.
I can neither confirm nor deny that I agree
that
with
is
this
a thing. That is a film that is set at Christmas time,
mm-hmm.
and the fact that it's set at Christmas time amplifies the message of generosity and community spirit,
mm-hmm.
but that film could literally be set any time of the year and have more or less the same impact.
Well, I was going to say, if it wasn't set at Christmas, then it would just be like a movie about a dude who might need to be locked up because he's suicidal, right?
Well, no, I mean, he's down on his luck, right? I mean, that's the run out of money. He's going to lose the family business, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. That all gets amplified by setting in the holiday season because
mm-hmm.
now it's not just that all of that and you can't buy presents for your family.
Yeah.
Right? So, I mean, there's just that extra layer of... but then again, that also lets you explore that Christmas isn't, I mean, It's a Wonderful Life is a great example because it doesn't end with everything being okay.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the villain never gets his comeuppance, right?
Mm-hmm.
And what it ends with is Christmas is about more than just presents. And by extension, life is about more than you being a productive member of society. It's about what happens when people come together and help each other and love each other. Mm-hmm. And again, you said that at Christmas, and it just gives you extra bang for your buck, because I think people naturally want to believe things like that. And Christmas is one of the few times of year that no matter what religion you follow, no matter what belief system you ascribe to, at least in American culture, everyone gets to cheat and be a little bit more generous, mm-hmm. without being called sappy or sentimental or religious or whatever.
Or if you're called sappy, it's like with a like kind of a knowing or accepting smile.
That's Christmas.
That's you're just too kind. You're just, you know, some of that stuff going on, and people were like, oh, okay, well, yeah, pass, you know. Well, I guess when I think of Die Hard, I think not only does it have lots of allusions, lots of not even very hard to draw parallels, symbols, themes that we could correlate to biblical narrative, things like that, that I am almost positive that either the writer of the novel or the writer of the screenplay did not intend. But I think that's another thing that connects us to it. I mean, and outside of that, like when I argued for it as a Christmas movie against people who were like, well, you know, well, it doesn't have the things a Christmas movie has. I was like, what else do you need? Like, it's got decorations. It's got a Christmas party. It's on Christmas Eve. The whole movie is...
there's a present, right? He brings a giant bear for his kids.
Yes. There's gift giving. There's gift giving of the bear, and there's gift giving of the, you know, of the dead bad guy.
Yeah. or a machine gun to him.
Yeah.
There are lots of gifts.
The entire soundtrack is Christmas music. Mm-hmm. You know, it starts with Christmas music. Christmas music, you know, goes up and down all through the middle of it, and then it ends with like a Let It Snow. And there's snow. You know, they have this wide shot of all the paper coming out of, you know, Nakatomi Tower or whatever. And it looks like it's snowing, mm-hmm. in L.A. of all places. And I'm like, there are some movies that are set at Christmas. But when you watch Die Hard, they use Christmas as a storytelling tool.
Yeah.
Like actively in the tale. It's not like, and it just sets the scene because we have the family there together, or we want to be able to amplify generosity or amplify this other, you know, goodness of whatever. It's like they keep continuing to using the imagery, the sounds, and the things that we're familiar with, mm-hmm. with Christmas to tell the story. And I'm just like, okay, what else do you want? You're just mad because there's machine guns.
Well, and like I said too, the thing that I love about this film is that it makes you see those things in a new way. I mean, the Ode to Joy, if I'm correct, is usually played, I think almost only played when we're looking at the terrorists, mm-hmm. and the, you know, the vault is opening to them, and it's playing.
It's Hans's theme.
Yeah.
Right? The first time you hear it is that, whoa, 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 yeah. whoa, whoa, whoa. And that's when you first meet Hans Gruber. Mm-hmm. Right? Yeah.
And then, you know, and then you've got, like, the very cheerful, cartoony tape that's, like, that is holding a gun to his bloodied back.
Yeah.
I mean, everything is just very contrasted, which I think helps you to see some of these things in a new way. Mm-hmm. Like, what does that mean to you? So I think that's really unique about this particular Christmas film that is actually a pretty nuanced layer that I'm not sure if it was intentional or not, but it's something that not every Christmas movie has. Mm-hmm. They tend to be crutches more than like storytelling devices.
Yeah. Well, and I'd say it was probably fairly intentional to do the contrast and make it kind of play up that kind of counter imagery. Mm-hmm. Now, like I said, there are things that happen story-wise that I don't think they would have ever intended to make allusion to. Mm-hmm. The kind of things that you can read probably in great detail and JR's write-up of how Die Hard is the greatest Christmas.
My favorite part about your review is when you have the picture of him and the caption is, "Yes, this metaphor breaks down." Because, that's the thing, that it's not like a cohesive narrative that you can... I mean, there's a lot of breakdown, but there are some really cool things that you can pick out of it that are parallel to Christ coming and... Mm-hmm. I don't know if we're gonna get into this, but
I wanted to make one other comment about just in general why people have a problem with this. And you said it, Mikey. It's like, but it has machine guns.
Yeah.
You know? I think that a lot of people, when they think of Christmas and Christmas movies, it's all love, joy, and peace.
Mm-hmm.
And again, that's particularly problematic for we Christians, because if we read Matthew's Christmas story, there is the slaughter of the innocents, there's the evil empire and the person of Herod, right? There is a dark side to the Christmas story, and there's plenty of room, not only in the Christmas story, but in the story of Jesus's life and death and resurrection, for these like more violent images of this person who has come to rescue us from the clutches of evil.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why I think if we're willing to take those parts of the Christmas story and of the Jesus story more seriously, we shouldn't have any problem at all with Die Hard being a fantastic Christmas story.
Yeah.
One thing that I just noticed this time was this whole thing about her changing her name.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know, that meant something to me. I guess I've been thinking about that a lot lately, about legacy, but he's offering his... You know, he's offering his name to her, and she's not willing to take it. She's kind of on the fence between, do I want the marriage or do I want the career? You know, am I going to need to sacrifice one for the other? And she clearly still loves him, but anyway, that was just kind of an interesting parallel to me.
Did you guys get the feeling that the film was judging John McClane for not following her?
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I did too. Like, which again, for a late 80s action film, is pretty impressive that, you know, the wife has this great career opportunity and she takes it and moves the family, and the film doesn't condemn her for that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, McClane ends up coming off as the prideful, hyper, you know, too masculine guy who can't just like be supportive.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, they do it really simply too. Because he basically has that conversation at the beginning where he's asked, like, why didn't you follow her? And he gives, like, a really terrible response. Mm-hmm. You know, he has a chance right then to lay out, like, who is the bad guy in this situation? Is it her for leaving or is it me for staying? And he's like, well, you know, they got 9 months of backlogs. You know, there's always going to be more bad guys to catch.
Yep.
You know, and he's like, you didn't think
Arlo, Arlo throws her right back in his face, right? Yeah.
Yeah, he's like, you didn't think she's going to make it. He's like I said, you're very perceptive, Arlo.
Yeah. The way, again, just time out of the theology for a second, the way this script delivered information to us was just beautiful.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
It told us almost nothing, and it showed us nearly everything from the get-go. Every piece that was set up was paid off. I know you already said that earlier, but it's worth repeating. Like, this script is just amazing.
Yeah, and it's really weird, because how do you make an action / subtle humor... I mean, it actually is very much like a Shane Black script,
you know,
like a Lethal Weapon kind of script, like a Iron Man 3. Like, there are stakes, but everyone's kind of like quipping at each other, you know, kiss, kiss, bang, bang kind of stuff like that. Like, people are dying, the stakes are real, but everyone's got time to like be funny or say kind of like things that keep it light enough. And that's very hard to do. That's very, very, very hard to do. And I think something to really note is that most of the things that we could point out, they're cool as illusions, but much like JR's article points out, most of these things, or almost everything in here, breaks down at some point.
Right.
Because the fact that, you could take a step back and say, oh, look at what kind of metaphor this is, because, you know, Holly McClane had a chance to stay with her husband and make family first, but she chose success and power and went across, you know, ran away and then gave up this name that was given to her. And, you know, it starts to sound very familiar to a story that, you know, we're used to. And then John McClane comes in.
Leaves everything, right? Yeah,
leaves and goes his after world. Her. Yeah, yep. Leaves his world and comes down to L.A., you know, to pursue her, even in their, you know, in her disagreement. And now, like I said, the thing where it obviously breaks down a lot is because there's lots of sexism kind of in there. But the cool thing about the movie is that it kind of points out that John's kind of maybe not the right one in this situation, which is cool because it makes the movie a little more stomachable, but it also kind of breaks down, like, you know, Christ obviously wasn't sexist.
Right. Well, also there seems to be an exchange of saving because, I mean, it seems clear that John is the hero and he's saving everybody. Everybody else is sitting around on their hands or doesn't understand the situation. But especially with that scene where his feet are bleeding, he's pulling the glass out, and he's talking to Al on the radio.
We just needed Thomas to come up and touch his feet.
it seems pretty clear that he was in need of some kind of paradigm shift or some saving. He didn't realize what he had been given, what he had, and he needed to be reminded of that.
Yeah.
And that actually, like, the act of loving by trying to save not just his wife, but trying to salvage a situation, actually showed him what he had been given.
I like to say, as John McClane is trying to bring peace to the fallenness of the world of Nakatomi Tower.
Yeah.
But there are some really cool parallels to the Christ figure thing. I mean, he comes with nothing, you know. He's very stripped down.
Well, and he, as you just said, right? He's perfected through his suffering, right? It is the ordeal that he undergoes that makes him able to rescue his bride, and that's, you know, in my article I quoted Hebrews, where it says, you know, he learned obedience through his suffering, and having been made perfect, he became the source of salvation for all who believe. Like, it's that idea that it's, you know, if Jesus had not been crucified, he could not save us. Like, it was the trial that made him able to rescue us from the clutches of sin and death. So we see that in a parallel but not identical way with John, where he is perfected. He's completed. He is finished. You know, and he is made the person who is able to rescue his wife.
Yeah.
And I love to, there's so many callbacks in this, so many things that are set up in the first act that come back towards the end. And I do love that after Holly witnesses what he's willing to go, the lengths to which he's willing to go to save her, that's when she says, you know, he says, "Oh, this is my wife, Holly Gennaro," and she says, "McClane, Holly McClane." So she's, you know, she's willing to fall in love with or to give to that love that has sacrificed so much for her.
Because again, you can imagine from her perspective, right? He wasn't willing to.
Right.
He wasn't. He let her leave, and he didn't follow, and he apparently had no intention. And so even to the extent that she wasn't sure if he actually even got on the plane.
Yeah.
You know? And so, yeah, when she sees how far he is willing to go to save her, of course she falls in love with him. Yeah.
Well, the funny thing about the film there's lots of funny things, but one of the funny things about the film is that lots of these allusions, especially when they start breaking down, could allow people to do with this film one of the things that's kind of a pet peeve to me, which is when pastors take like a small piece of a film and they use it as a sermon example. But if you actually took that theme or that idea and you tried to run it through the whole course of the whole film, it would easily break down and quickly break down. So then when people go and watch the whole thing and they're expecting the sermon illustration, it gets terrible. And acknowledging that, it's still interesting to see that there are those themes that go from start to finish with some roughness in the middle. Because I like that they introduce like the Rolex right at the beginning. It's another one of those things that like gets introduced and totally pays off in the end, because that Rolex is a symbol in the film of Holly's almost rejection of John. And in our larger metaphor of John leaving the perch of New York to, you know, come, you know, low himself to L.A. That is what she's, that is her prize. You know, that is her pearl of great price, that Rolex. Even though she's kind of embarrassed about it when she's called on it.
Or which, at least it represents what she's yeah. gotten.
So it not only represents that. And like I said, she's a little bit embarrassed of it, which when people call us, like, on our sin, like, we're usually a little embarrassed about it when we feel there's, like, a conviction of what she's done. And then it's not until she throws off this thing at the end of the film that she's...
With the help of her rescuer, right?
With the help of her rescuer, that they're finally able to do in the evil one, you know?
But almost kills her, right?
Yeah, but it almost kills her.
It's like her last link to...
Yeah, it was the thing that was dragging her out the window, you know? So
how does Al fit into this... The whole
thing. He is clearly the Holy Spirit.
I put that in my notes too. It's like he's a voice whispering encouragement and giving John wisdom from the outside.
He's the helper. He's the advocate on John's behalf.
That's right. Oh man.
That seems to be there seems to be some themes there that are continuous through the film that maybe wouldn't break down so much as the savior metaphor.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know, kind of the friendship. They help one another. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't explored it very well, though.
So,
much.
To stay on Al, or Carl Winslow, whatever you want to call him.
I really want, like, family... What is it, Family Matters?
Yeah.
I want
that
to be, like, a Die Hard spinoff.
Yeah.
It is the Die Hard universe.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, Urkel could have been, like, the guy driving the car, you know?
In the Christmas special one year, he's like, kids, let me tell you a story. Uncle John's coming over. Uncle John!
Oh, that's why he had to move to Chicago.
Yep.
Because, you know, he's too popular in L.A. But oh yeah, so staying on the Al character for a bit, but not necessarily talking about like a Holy Spirit kind of correlation. The thing that I really like, and I think we could learn about the goodness of Al, is that another one of my pet peeves is not being able to have male friendships in movies.
Mm-hmm.
Because I feel like guys are either depicted as like inept at making friendship. If they actually become close, like they have to spin into some kind of romantic love. But you see more than because it's more than buddy cops. Like they're not just, you know, it's not got your back because I shot the guy before you did. It's,
yeah, they have no history, which is really interesting.
Yeah, they're not just like partners. It's like I need to connect with somebody, and two grown men find connection and encouragement, and it keeps John going. And
helps Al grow by the
by the end of the film, Al also pulls something away from it, and I really appreciate that relationship. As kind of corny as some of their dialogue is, which I think actually works better because two dudes trying to talk about their feelings over a walkie-talkie. Like, it's awkward, but they keep pressing on. And so the older I get and the more valuable I find other male friendship, the more I really resonate with the Al and John kind of back and forths.
Mm-hmm.
And it makes that moment where they've never actually seen each other. They don't know what the other one looks like. John may kind of roughly... like know what Al looks like from looking out the window, but you know he's like, you know, like 30 or 28 stories up, something like that. And so you know he probably just sees like that it's a black police officer.
Mm-hmm.
So when he walks out and like Al's the only person looking at him, like Al's looking at him, and he knows exactly who he is, and they share that moment. It's really great, and it like I said, it shouldn't work so much. For a 1988 like action movie about a dude killing Germans in a Japanese business tower, like there's nothing about this that sounds rational or that sounds like it should work. So
and yet
it does. So, what else we got?
Yeah, that's interesting. That kind of fits in with what I was saying about John maybe not as the primary savior, as but as somebody being saved by his experience,
mm-hmm.
is that in the end, after all that, he was about to die, and then Al's the one who saved him. But I guess Al would not have been able to shoot. Was it Carl?
I think it's Carl.
Yeah.
Or was Carl the brother?
No, it was Carl.
He would not have been able to do that if John hadn't kind of talked to him about.
Yeah, had like not shared his experiences. And
mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's why that friendship worked, is because, and maybe it was the distance of the walkie-talkie allowed them that like that bit of anonymity that a lot of people need, to be honest. But,
mm-hmm.
you know, the moments that they share their intimacy were the kind of the quiet moments where nothing's happening, right?
Mm-hmm.
And everyone's waiting on the next thing. And you know, John's alone with his thoughts, and Al is on the ground, you know, the only person on the ground who believes in him, right?
Mm-hmm.
Who believes that he is who he says he is, and who that he is trying to help instead of, you know, trying to hurt. And their willingness to be real was beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
I will say that we'll still have a little bit more time to hit anything else, but I wanted to kind of start moving us towards winding down.
Okay.
So is there anything, Laura, in this movie that you didn't like? You love everything. I'm okay with that answer because this movie's amazing.
I do love everything about it. I don't like the fact that we have to watch it so late on New Year or on Christmas Eve that I always fall asleep by the time he's like fighting Carl. I'm always asleep, and then I wake up for the end. That's the only thing. I was so glad to watch it earlier this year, so right. that we could
gotta edit our traditions.
The whole thing. No, I really can't think of anything that, like, annoys me or bores me or, you know, and that's hard, too, because most of my come-on moments for the podcast tend to be things that made me roll my eyes. But I'm always rolling my eyes in this movie, and I love it.
Because the movie's rolling its eyes.
Right, yes. Yeah. So I just can't.
I'm fine with that.
Okay.
JR?
Yeah, Alan Rickman's German accent is pretty terrible. it's like 90% good, but the 10% that it's not good, and it's actually the way he says his THs,
mm-hmm.
is specifically what's wrong with it, is instantly, clearly, that he is not really German.
What about that American accent, though?
Yeah.
American accent's great. No, I mean, that's fantastic, and that's one of the greatest parts of the film. There's so many reversals all packed in together. Right? Mm-hmm. Where, like, you're like, oh, he found Hans. Oh, my gosh. Hans tricked him. Oh, he tricked Hans! it's so great.
And that takes us to our favorite moments.
But, yeah, it's honestly, his German accent just really irritates me, like, every time I watch the movie, and I just have to, like, make peace with it when the opening credits are starting.
Bill Clay.
Doesn't he have, like, he has, like, some kind of... He had a speech impediment or something that he had to overcome, didn't he?
I don't know. I wish Google could tell us.
Well, maybe I'll Google that.
James Earl Jones and a stuttering problem?
I'm thinking, like, oh, everyone who has, like...
No, I'm pretty sure that Alan Rickman had some kind of speech impediment, and I'm going to find that out.
Uh-oh. Well, okay, so I'm going to mention something as my come-on moment just so I have a chance to mention it. But it's really not something that I would do without, and it's not something that makes me kind of really say come on, but it's probably the best place for it, considering otherwise I would have nothing. And that is the entire, it's not even a B story really at this point, it's like a C story of the news reporter.
Okay.
Gosh, I wrote his name down. Richard Thornburg. You know, like, he's going around, like, he hears the story, he's trying to scoop the guy behind the desk, because we even get some shots of the guy behind the desk, like, acting like a tool.
Yeah.
You know? And I'm like, what is this entire story about? Because it seems like it should be, I feel like, and I probably would have been wrong to do so, I feel like if I wrote this movie, I would have made Richard Thornburg the guy who covers it right, and the guy in the studio the guy who's covering it wrong.
Mm-hmm.
You know, to and you kind of can say something. He's get to overcome something, kind of like your other kind of heroes do. But he's just a tool, and at best I can say it's pointing out the ineptitude of media I would say it's pointing out the willingness to do, oh, there's a good word for it.
The willingness to like to do whatever it takes to get something.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And there's a great word for that. The opportunist kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
The opportunist of media, you know, not really concerned in any way about the actual people, the living people involved in a story.
Yeah.
But just getting the story. And I feel like it's a critique of that. Mm-hmm. But it's not only that, but then it's a critique of the ineptitude of media in general when they show like the and we're interviewing so-and-so about like what's it like being, you know, a terrorist.
Well, and gosh, that was how long before our 24-hour news networks and like
mm-hmm.
all of, I mean, that's that critique is so on point today.
Exactly.
And this film came out almost 30 years ago.
Exactly.
Like amazing.
So that's why I would not take it out. And if I were writing the script, I would have made the wrong choice. But it's kind of weird because we keep cutting to these people. And honestly, the only, like, I feel like if you take that entire story out, there's only, like, it's a lot of scenes and it's a lot of story and it's a lot of pseudo character development for those characters. And it's a big thing that pays off, but it's mainly just so we can interview the kids.
Well, but it's also how Hans figures out who Holly is.
Yeah, because he interviews the kids.
Right. I mean, that's the payoff.
But that's a lot of backstory. That's a lot of character development. That's a lot of like us following Richard Thornburg around just to get to that.
So I guess I loved that because it was one more thing that any other movie would have just like had him pick the picture up off the desk for no good reason.
Mm-hmm.
And coincidentally, you know, and at that point you have to ask yourself in the story, well, why not do that in act one?
Yeah.
Why wait until act three? Oh, literally because you needed it to happen in act three. Like there's no good reason for that to happen just then.
Mm-hmm.
And instead they tease it. And then they make the way it happens like an inevitable part of the story.
Mm-hmm.
Like it was always going to happen that way.
Like I said, that's why I would never take it out.
Right.
That's why it can't be a come on moment, because it completely works and it completely heightens the film. It's just they really committed to that idea.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know.
But what? Yeah. And I mean, I know you've already said you wouldn't take anything out, but like, I don't know that you could take anything out and then have that be believable at that point.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you had to have him so desperate that he's hunting. You had to have him the first one on the scene. You had to, you know, you had to have a reason that this guy was going to go harass these kids in the middle of the night and threaten their super nice nanny and, you know, all that.
Mm-hmm.
And when you get that, like, yeah, he's probably actually like a pretty decent guy. He's just like cutthroat, you know, like he's so tired of getting crapped on. He'll do whatever it takes.
Mm-hmm.
Well,
and he wants to be better, more intelligent than the guy who's mm-hmm. on TV. But I think it does say something that he has to resort to probably very similar methods to get anywhere in that field.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why it's really interesting to me, because I am picturing like, well, I mean, I would say the writer's room for that, but it's based on a novel and I'm not sure how to the novel it is. So either in writing the novel or writing actually in the novel, they probably had tons of time to flesh all that out. And maybe that's what happened. It didn't look like it was quite as fleshed out in the movie, or like it was almost seemed like it was unnecessarily fleshed out. Even though, like I said, it totally worked, because if this was a normal writer's room, I can imagine someone saying, well, how is Hans eventually going to find out? We've been teasing it for two acts. You know, we need him to find out eventually. We don't want him to find out in act one. And someone's like, oh, well, they can just see a news report. And he's like, okay. Well, cool. And he's like, well, what if it wasn't just like a news report? Like, why would they be interviewing? Oh, because some dude's trying to get the story. Oh, what kind of dude would try to get that story? And like this, it just kind of goes and goes. And they're like, well, why is he so cutthroat? Oh, because the guy behind the desk is such a...
That's commitment to storytelling.
Yeah, that's like when you...
But you know, like, I know I'm not arguing with anyone here, but God, that, like, one of the great things about this film is how fleshed out all of the characters are. Mm-hmm. Like, there's not a character that you spend more than 10 seconds of screen time with that you don't have a good, like, even Agents Johnson and Johnson, mm-hmm. right? Like, you think that they're, like, buddy-buddy cop and all that, and then you get that little bit in the helicopter who's like, just like Saigon, eh, Slick? And he's like, I was in high school or whatever. Yeah. Like, you get the, oh, okay, like, they're, like, all's not...
Yeah, well, they're not buddy-buddy. You know, whatever. Yeah.
And it was just, like, a little thing, but you just... They're way more fleshed out than they have any business being, having mm-hmm. that little screen time.
Yep. Well, so Laura, what was your favorite moment in this movie? What is your favorite part of watching this every year?
I guess I would say my favorite scene is when he's talking to Al about she's heard me say a million times I love her. She's never heard me say I'm sorry.
Oh, yes.
I don't know. I just love that scene. And then, of course, Al being like, you're going to tell yourself, man. You're going to tell yourself. But I just had so much fun, particularly this year, watching it. And just knowing the lines that were going to come. And we would say, like, we would say them before they mm-hmm. came. And, you know, we'd say them in the same way. And I don't know, just, I love that. It's really campy and cheesy. But we just love, I don't know, just love the script so much.
Okay, it's kind of surprising to me.
Why?
I didn't think you liked that scene that much.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I thought you were going to say lots of other things, but I'm glad. It saves them all for me. I was just taken aback. I had to take a breath.
Well, I have on here when he's in the vents, and he's like,
where did it go? When he lives.
I was gonna say my secret favorite part is whenever he's talking to himself.
Yeah.
Oh yeah.
He's like, how come you didn't stop him, John? He'd be dead too, a-hole. And he's like it's just like that constant monologue. And then yeah, when he's in the vents, like yeah. It's just so, because I think that's the way the film is poking fun at itself, right? It's yeah. It's allowing John to say all of the things about his own situation, you know, that we want to say.
Yeah.
Right. When he's got the fire hose and he's gonna jump over and he's just he pauses and he's like, I'm about to die. he has that moment of hesitation where he's like, this is not gonna work, I'm gonna die. And then he just goes ahead and does it. It's like that's what makes this movie head and shoulders above other action
right.
films, you know. Oh. And it's that kind of stuff where we get to see, even in the action sequences without him saying a word, like we get to see how scared he is and how desperate he is. And then of course the line is just it's just awesome. Like, there's a reason it's a catchphrase now, you know. Mm-hmm.
What, yippee kayak other buckets?
Yep, that's right. Yippee kayak other buckets.
Oh, well, it seems like it should be like the last thing he says.
It is in all the other movies, right? And that's why it's so fun in this one. Like, I remember, you know, by the time I was an adult, I had seen all the Die Hards on USA, mm-hmm. all three of them, because I, you know, it was before 4 came out.
Yeah.
And so you just, you got them all mixed up. You didn't remember what order they came in. You knew that was the tagline. And so when I actually sat down and rewatched Die Hard for the first time, like, to watch Die Hard, and he drops it, like, in the middle of the movie, I was like, what? Mm-hmm.
Well,
you know.
It's great too, because actually the last person to say it, I think, is Hans.
Yeah. That's right.
He was trying to like turn the tables on him, and then it's like, oh no.
And that amazing German accent.
Oh, yeah. And then McClane starts laughing, uh-huh. right? I mean, it's just, it's such a, it's so great.
Well, that's the thing, because I wonder if they knew that was going to be the line, though. Because what does he say at the end? Doesn't he give him like some kind of John Wayne quote or something? I remember going that was the line I think they thought, because mm-hmm. it's like when he shoots Han he shoots the only non German looking dude there,
mm-hmm.
And then Hans, and he says something. Oh man, this is killing me! I can't believe I don't know this off the top of my head. But he says something right after he does it, and I was like, I bet that's what they thought the catchphrase was going to be, and it's just Nothing.
You can't pick your catchphrase. It
yeah.
just happens.
Well, it's whatever people, you know. Mm-hmm.
People try all the time to write a good catchphrase, and it almost never works.
Yeah. That's actually what I was talking to Mark about when we were writing. I was like, I think any of these would be our catchphrase, and it's not going to be any of them. It's going to be one of these other things. It's going to be people are going to remember. Because it's weird what people just kind of, what people will stick with.
Mm-hmm.
So, you're at your, if you have to pick something or a thing or two, JR, what is your favorite?
Oh, I was serious about it. It's like the little moments of him talking.
Oh, that was it? Okay.
Like that. I mean, cool. That's seriously, but yeah, the best holy crap moment, I mean, it's that final scene with his gun taped on his back and laughing and, you know, all of, like, it's all just staged so perfectly. Yeah, I love it. I love it. I love it. I love it.
So I think any time that, because the situations are pretty hilarious too, but any time that Alan Rickman has to say something very slowly in German, I think those are my favorite parts, because it's not like every time we're watching Die Hard and I take a picture of us watching the movie, I always want to take a picture of the dead dude in the elevator with the Santa hat on and the, you know, the gray sweatshirt that says, "Now I have a machine gun." Ho, ho, ho. And Alan Rickman, he just has, like, leans over and he hasn't even pulled the sweater down a little bit to read the ho, ho, ho. And he's like, "Now I have a machine gun." Ho, ho, ho. I'm just like, because he could have delivered that line so many ways.
There's just so much disdain. I actually did think of one moment that is probably my favorite moment in the whole movie.
Okay.
It's the moment when they've come back from trying to kill him and they haven't, and he gets away walking on the broken glass, and Carl comes back in and he's like destroying the main level where the party is, and Holly gets this big grin on her face and she goes, "He's still alive." And the lady's like, "How do you know that?" She goes, "Only John could make someone that angry." And it's like, yes!
Oh, well, so what else does he do? So it's the yippee, it's when he says the yippee-ki-yay as well.
Yep.
I think he just reminded me of something else. And then I forgot it because I didn't write it down.
I'll tell you my one other, I also remembered my other holy, like, come on moment.
Uh-huh.
I'm sorry, I should have done my homework better.
Uh-huh.
But it's when, it's in the glass shooting scene, that's what.
Oh, yeah, that was it.
It's when Hans says, Scheiß dem Fenster, which is shoot the windows in German, and Carl's like, "What?" And he says it again in German, and Carl goes, "What?" And then he says it in English, and Carl's like, "Now I understand that you're speaking in my second language." Again, I understand that they did that for us, the non-German-speaking American audience, but I was like, oh, gosh. That's like the one flaw in an otherwise perfect script.
I mean...
That was another slow Hans moment.
Yeah, that was what I was thinking about.
Shoot the glass.
The glass. And then he gives like that, like, little, like, eye nod. Oh, it's great.
That's just like a phrase that you can only understand in English, don't you know? That's like...
Yeah.
Yeah. He's like, shoot the window.
She's Dan Fenster.
Shoot the window? That doesn't even make sense.
I don't understand. Why would I? Why? With a gun?
I'm totally looking up the whole Die Hard script right now. So
you missed your window, Mikey.
I did miss my window. I'm going to.
What's your favorite part?
I stalled as much as I could.
No, you did. But then I kept having to jump anyway. So I think. Something that I always appreciated about this film, to make it like one of my favorite moments, is that what you pointed out earlier, JR, about how like the Ode to Joy is used basically as Hans' theme, and unless you're really listening for it, I don't think like it's so subtle because it's so slow and like kind of like depressing, you know, it's just like. You know, like very slow, but it's always in the background.
Mm-hmm.
And then when they open the vault and like the light shines out. This is another one of those like illusion moments. And then it finally just like the hallelujah, you know, like Ode to Joy kind of chorus, kind of ta-da, you know. Mm-hmm. It's just this really cool scene to finally see the tone change and then embrace that song. And it kind of kicks in that's the song they've been playing the entire time. Mm-hmm. And it's just really cool piece of filmmaking. That's probably my favorite part. Just because of how they do it. Which, I say it's my favorite part, but...
Until you think of your other favorite
part. But yeah, it's one of those things where, like, we obviously love this entire... we love this entire movie, so it's hard to pick a favorite part. Which is, you know, defensibly, why this piece of the show has gone on for so long.
It's Christmas, Mikey.
JR, any final thoughts?
I will defend that this is a Christmas movie in that it is set at Christmas.
Uh-huh.
And that it has themes. What I wrote in my article, right, was, and it struck me, I'll tell you, if you didn't read my article, which I know you guys did, but listeners, if you didn't read it, the moment that it struck me when I was watching it at the Alamo, cap gun in hand, this Christmas, is when he staggers out of the darkness, covered in blood, and is like nearly dead on his feet, and Holly says Jesus. And I was like, oh, like it sounds like she's using the Lord's name in vain, but she is identifying him as the Christ figure in the film. And like, that was when it all came together for me. I was like, yeah, of course he is, right? Of course. And all of the things we've already talked about how his atonement is effective through his suffering and all that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. It is about incarnation. It is about persevering despite the limits of our flesh. It is a film that it is an anti-superhero movie, right?
Mm-hmm.
In that it is about what it means to be a person who can die and to persevere against that. And I mean, there's so much in the midst of that about incarnation, and that is the Christmas story. It's incarnation. It's God becomes weak and vulnerable. He becomes flesh. And so, yeah, I mean, it's to me, it's not as obvious as something like Elf. Or whatever, but it's a beautiful story. And again, from a purely filmmaking perspective, it's just marvelous. Mm. I can't believe how well it holds up. You know, 30 years later.
I think Lauren fell asleep.
No, I didn't. I'm contemplating.
So I love the fact that, yeah, exactly what you're saying, JR. That 30 years later, almost 30 years later, like, we can watch a movie like this and get so much out of it.
Mm-hmm.
Not only get so much out of it, but it just be still entertaining. It's hard to find a movie that's 30 years old, which is what I think everyone was flipping out about, like, Back to the Future and stuff. It's hard to watch a movie that's 30 years old and it not have lost so much in translation, or just because time killed it. I mean, that's what happens to lots of our action or sci-fi movies. You know, things that we thought were amazing stunts in the 80s typically don't hold up to, like, the crazy things we can do in, like, Fast and the Furious.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Or things we can portray with green screen.
Yeah. So, but
Lauren... Yeah, just to piggyback off what you're saying, to piggyback?
Piggyback.
Yes, I said that right. JR, I really was struck this time by realizing that the thing on the surface that we notice about John McClane is that he's just so cool. And we wish that we could be like that. Making the best of the situation. Always the most intelligent, always a step ahead of everybody else. Willing to risk his life, always coming out on top. Anyway. But the thing that really struck me this time was that whole element of weakness and brokenness, that underneath all of that, he still needs connection to other people. He needs other people's help. And I think that's really cool. I think that's what makes him such a relatable character, obviously. That we can say, he's not a superhero. He's just trying to do his best. And he needs community just like I do. you know, I guess almost giving the viewer the idea that we could be John McClane too, you know? Mm-hmm. I hope it's possible for us.
Halloween.
It's such an easy costume.
Mm. With that said, this has been an incredibly fun conversation. Talking about Die Hard cannot not be a fun conversation. And we wanted to basically say Merry Christmas. We enjoy doing these special Christmas episodes. And we want to know what your Christmas traditions are, what your favorite Christmas movies are. We always enjoy hearing that. Feel free to look back at our other Christmas episodes where we talk about Doctor Who, we talk about Elf. And if you want to keep talking about Die Hard with Laura or with JR, then I'm going to let you know how to do that by asking them to tell you. So, JR, how can people find what you do or interact with you?
Easiest way to find me is go to NorvalRogers.com. That's Shaggy from Scooby-Doo's real name if you can't figure out how to spell it. And I blog there. I have several podcasts hosted there, including the Storymen podcast, which is one of my main ones. And then you can find me on Twitter, on Facebook at JR Forresteros.
Awesome. Laura?
I'm on Twitter at Laura_Fissel, and I do writing for Real World Theology, and that's probably currently where I will interact and get into conversations with people.
Awesome. And I will make sure I have all of that in the show notes. And if you would like to follow me, feel free to do so at Fizzification on Twitter. Go to the show, all these show notes, all the places you can find JR and Laura will be up at realworldtheology.com. And we are always grateful for them. We're grateful for you guys. We hope you all have a very, very Merry Christmas, whether you celebrate it at the wrong time before Christmas Day or the proper time 12 days after Christmas. So thanks for listening. Thanks for making us part of your holiday season or Christmas season, depending on if you get up in arms about that kind of thing.
Which, if you made it all the way to the end of a Christmas episode, good for you.
Yeah, good for you. So thanks, and until next time, remember that story is powerful and entertainment is not mindless. Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas.
There you go.
Real World Theology production. For more information, check out realworldtheology.com. And thanks for listening.
Now this is podcasting. Woo!
That's weird.
Oh, that's what it was. Happy trails. Happy trails,
Happy
Hans.
Happy trails, Hans. Yep.
Oh, gotcha.
Happy trails, Hans.
Oh, man, that's right. Oh, gosh, I could not think of that. Wow, good call, Mikey.
Exactly.
I'm glad you remember.
Someone's got to do the heavy lifting.
Yeah, okay. Wow, thank you.
You're always so prepared.
Exactly.
You're such a professional.
It's true. Professional. It's true.
But you live hard and you die hard.
There you go.